So the city is right to capital. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some empirical premises for the paper briefly in a few slides. Then I'll read part of the paper. And then if you alert me 3 minutes to go, I'll go back to some more slides on the question of implementation and policy. I want to acknowledge some collaborators I've worked with this argument draws from, and particularly this green thing on the left that I'm doing with Steve Dubb and Gar Alperovitz, a book project that will hopefully be out next year on the question of climate change and community stability. And also draws on a previous book from David Ambrosio and also the Sproul book to some extent. Okay, so empirical premise one is that there is a significant link between central city residents and climate mitigation. I mean, lots of studies that could have cited just through some things up here. New York City has per capita emissions far lower than the national average in the U.S. Similar story for London. Glazer, who just referenced, has a journal article came out a year ago showing pretty much that central cities are lower than suburbs almost everywhere because of less driving and lower energy use due to smaller homes. So that's one premise. The second premise, you can think of this as sort of the global justice constraint on the next generation of urban development, which is it's estimated industrialized countries must cut per capita carbon emissions about 50% by 2030, 90% plus by 2050 if climate's to be stabilized long-term and acceptable level. Because the U.S. is so much higher than even other industrialized countries, policy has a moral obligation to cut even faster. But lo and behold, guess what? The population is projected to increase. So this is a particular challenge. And so if we're going to be serious about this, we have to do a lot of different things at all various levels, but one of which has to do with patterns of urban development. And whatever else we do, it seems to me that we cannot throw away the existing cities that have a relatively low carbon footprint. It's not to say that this city should not be improved. Obviously, existing central cities need a lot of green work to done, but certainly they're a better starting point than the typical car-driven suburb. If you go back and look at the last 60 years of urban development in the United States, the pattern is that many cities see populations decline over time, even in the context of overall population growth of the country. And I just list here the cities that have lost 50,000 or more from their population peak. So this is not their 1950 population, but whatever their peak was, for a lot of them it was like 1960 or 1970, and they're now below that. And this is 29 out of 112, and actually about half the cities of that 112 who are 100,000 or more have actually lost over that time period, and some of them quite massively. And I think, and this part of my argument is not just the impact on these cities, but the fact that this is possible, the impact that it has on politics everywhere else is what I want to call attention to. And so the big claims here is that community stability has implications for viability of cities, ecological sustainability of cities, the internal justice or urban justice of cities. And I don't talk about this in the paper, but I also think there is a larger order social justice implication of this as well. And the root issue is that cities are inherently rooted in geographic place, but many forms of capital are mobile. Okay, so in the paper, I'll just leave this up there because it's a good place to stop. I'm asserting that cities have a right to capital, and that is a right to productive capital of sufficient quantity to productively employ all willing workers within the city and sufficient stability to secure the long-term viability of the city. And where this right is not honored, prospects for social justice weaken dramatically, as do prospects for ecological sustainability. But securing this right in practice will, in many, if not most cases, require the development and extension of communal forms of capital, that is, capital controlled by and closely tied to the residents of particular places. And this means that conventional capitalist modes of property ownership must be challenged both by the cities themselves and by regional and or national institutions. So basically, I'm arguing for three basic claims. First, at the most basic level, cities have a right to continue to exist as viable communities. By viability, I mean that each city must provide sufficient economic prospects and sufficient quality of life to retain its population willingly over time. I don't want them to, I'm not forcing people to stay, but we want them to stay because they want to, rather than turn into a ghost town, you know, like Detroit. And secondly, and closely related, cities have a right to thrive as prosperous, sustainable, and just communities, or perhaps more plausibly, there's a right to have sufficient resources to have the realistic possibility of becoming such sustainable and just places. A city without sufficient resources to meet these basic economic requirements is condemned to zero-sum conflicts over two scarce resources whose resolution will ordinarily be regulated by the balance of political power rather than considerations of justice. And third, to be assured that the cities have sufficient resources, they must, possess sufficient capital to employ each of the citizens. Now, clearly, even when cities possess adequate resources and meet all these requirements, it's no easy matter to achieve measures of local social justice or ecological sustainability. So I'm talking about here is a necessary, clearly not a sufficient condition for achieving these things. So why do I think that community economic stability is central to the possibility of achieving justice? And here I draw pretty straightforwardly from the empirical literature on regime theory, based on studies of U.S. cities. Ordinarily, urban political leaders have jobs and job creation at or near the top of their priority list. But at the same time, while that's the top priority, the locality itself does not have the capacity to create those jobs directly, or if they do have the capacity, often not the willingness. So instead, they typically develop policies aimed at attracting new businesses, especially larger corporations, to move to the city, as well as take steps intended to retain existing businesses. It's the fond wish of every mayor to preside over a city considered business-friendly, and localities often try to outdo one another in coming up with the most business-friendly city slogan. Usually, you pass the city limits of a city in the U.S., and it's, wherever it is, open for business, and they mean that quite literally. And business interests, typically have disproportionate political influence at the local level, and so too do owners of downtown land and other valuable property within the city, people who have a vested interest in seeing economic growth. And so the combined interests of existing business owners, downtown land interests, and politicians form the basis of a growth coalition. And what's key here is that support for the growth coalition often attracts progressive politicians as well, who are interested in providing jobs to those sectors of the city there where there's underemployment or systemic underemployment. So there's both an internal weight from the concentration of resources in the existing businesses, which I think will always be there, but there's also this external weight, which is the need to attract the mobile capital from outside to shore up employment within the city. Okay, so elected officials, no matter how progressive or inclined to social justice, cannot easily escape the gravitational weight of these coalitions. Instead, political logic and the reality of competition with other localities for jobs, whether they be your local suburb or a city somewhere else, dictates that mayors and city officials do whatever it takes, whatever it seems likely to work to attract capital. And most typically, this means that cities pursue development strategies that are non-redistributive in character, often very involving subsidizing business to move there. And at best, you might get, in a few cases, certainly, there have been linkage policies where you get the subsidy, but you have to do something else, like create affordable housing, or clawbacks where you take the subsidy, but if you violate your promises, we can sue you and get the money back. That's certainly possible, but oftentimes the practice has been that cities expend scarce resources on subsidies or direct assistance to mobile firms with few or any strings attached. And importantly, even at their best, the conventional economic development strategies rarely prioritize the creation of good-paying entry-level or blue-collar jobs for the people who actually live in the city already. It's oftentimes let's get the high-tech thing that will be sexy, but who's going to do those jobs? It's often people coming in from somewhere else. So yeah, I would contend urban economic development succeeds, its impact on raising the standard of living of existing residents is often mixed or negligible. But even worse is when it fails. So in circumstances in which capital is scarce and can move freely between cities in search of lower labor costs and higher public subsidies, typically bidding one city off against the other, in which there is no acknowledged right to capital, it's inevitable that some, if not many, cities will lose out on first jobs and then residents, and that was the point of the slide I showed before. Okay, great, thanks. And the population is certainly, it's an indicator, but it's a crude indicator that actually understates the actual human costs involved in this process. So long-term unemployment generates numerous well-documented social costs in the form of family breakups, depression, alcoholism, crime, and so on. As the people who can leave the community do so, the social capital infrastructure of the cities decays and declines, and so does the physical picture and finally the physical infrastructure itself. Yet even when the city manages to survive as a viable community, a place where at least some people can continue to live well, the existence of neighborhoods characterized by massive underemployment represents both a standing injustice and a threat to the city as a whole. Now, the standard recommendation has often been, well, you know, the jobs leave the city, the people should follow them. And maybe we'll put in trade adjustment assistance or other kinds of things to retraining and that sort of thing to help citizens find those new jobs somewhere else. But I think this sort of response is deeply inadequate and represents an acquiescence to injustice for a lot of reasons. I maybe not go through all of them, but central to what we're talking about here, being forced to leave the city because of economic necessity deprives citizens of the right to continue living in the community in which they've invested their lives. This response also radically devalues cities as democratic communities, places in which citizens learn the skills of self-governance and taking active role in shaping a common urban life. And as noted before, when the people start leaving, that often makes it worse for those who are left behind who don't have the resources to leave. And to reiterate a point, the fact that this is possible, even if it's not happening in your city, the fact that you know it could happen to you, it has an impact on the kind of politics that are possible. Another exception to this, and the obvious exceptions, are college towns or other relatively small state capitals. And I don't think it's a coincidence. And there's clearly an education effect, but there's also a community stability effect on why you get places like Madison, typically taking the lead on not just protests, but you know, sustainability initiatives and things like that, just more progressive politics in general. And I'm going to skip the ecology piece and just, as promised, go back to these slides. One basic distinction I make in sort of the second part of the paper is, which is pointing out that there is mobile capital, but there's also place-based forms of capital. And it's important to first acknowledge that these exist, and secondly, think about ways we can build on these. So there's government, there's meds and eds. Most novelly, there's firms that are community-owned in some sense, and that could take a variety of different forms. There's community development banks. Some local firms are really extremely tied to a particular place, and actually that's the way in the United States most firms become employee-owned firms is that the owner retires, doesn't want to see the factory collapse because they value the community, and so they convert it into an ESOP and get a big tax break. And then also the secondary small business sector, the mom-and-pop stores, the retail stores, the places that are serving the workers in the base industry. So to achieve this goal in practice, I argue for stabilizing the base sector employment in each geographic area. You think about it as a city or in very large cities, each section within the cities. I mean, if it, to the extent feasible, I like to stabilize every single neighborhood. But you might think about sectors at first. Okay. And you want to provide, I claim that you only have to think about planning part of the city economy. This is not a claim that you have to plan everything. So I am calling for planning, but it's a partial planning. If you get the basic sectors in place, the rest of it will follow naturally. More or less, the multiplier effect. And it's important that has to be achieved in every city. Okay, so what are the policy tools? The first thing, and maybe I understated this in the paper, but clearly you need a full employment, national level macroeconomic policy. You can't do this if you have 10-12% unemployment persistently. But it's interesting, even when in the late 90s, when unemployment was about 3.5% nationally in the U.S., there were still significant pockets and a significant number of cities who had continued to have massive problems. And that's one piece. The second piece is to the extent that you're going to use large public investment, stimulus packages, and so forth to achieve full employment, you should target that investment to distressed communities to the extent feasible and extent that makes sense. Other policy tools, there's definitely a local component to this. You can do import substitution at the local level, and you can do local and state efforts to build up place-based forms of capital. And then the novel part, and this is the part where I would see the right to capital being operated, is essentially regional development banks that target resources to faltering cities and cities hit by major disinvestment. And I can talk about some more of that there. But basically just give you, I'll stop with this slide. There's, I think about policy precursors at the local level in Cleveland, to our invoke our favorite city of the day. After, they obviously they've tried lots of things that haven't worked, but now they're going to literally trying to replicate the Mondragon model, system of cooperatives, in the university circles or working class neighborhood, and they're creating green sector cooperatives. They're linked up. They get contracts with the local universities and hospitals. Since they managed to get the existing place-based capital on board with supporting a cooperative sector that employs residents, the existing residents in blue-collar jobs. So that's a local example. A state example, Ohio Employee Ownership Center gives a lot of support to convert failing steel firms into worker ownership where feasible. And at the national level in the U.S., there are lots and lots of examples of the idea where the federal government is recognizing we should try to save communities. We should not allow them to die. So it's the Appalachian Regional Commission, Economic Development Administration, Community Development Block Grants, and I think the most interesting one is the military-based conversion process, where to make it politically acceptable to close these places, they said they got really serious and said, we're not going to let the communities die. They created all these mechanisms, put resources in to do serious conversion to keep those places viable community, and they've worked a lot of places. Then in the international, you could think about regional policy in Europe as related to this idea. And I do have the slide if you're interested in the Cleveland example or other local stuff. There's another report done some by colleagues that you can find at community-wealth.org. So I'll stop there.
Thanks. I really enjoyed the paper, and I'm quite interested by the argument, but I would like to have a better idea of the qualifications to this principle. Maybe two sub-questions. First, what do you do with a city like Detroit that you mentioned in the face of the collapse of the auto industry? And second, what do you do with, I'm from Quebec City, which has been for a week now the most left-wing city in the country. And now we decide that for a viable city, needs free public transit and free daycare and free I don't know what and so on. And we think, well, that's what we need in a viable city. And even though we don't really have the money for that, we have a city's right to capital. And therefore, we know that if we lack funds to thrive, someone will help us, thanks to all those conservative mayors that will preserve fundings in our country, something like that.
So, could you restate the second question?
The second one is, what's the qualification in front of a city that would use this principle to just make many expenses that they could not afford to make in other situation.
Okay. Well, first of all, about Detroit, that's a tough question. What to do now with Detroit is hard. And so my principle is more aimed at preventing the next Detroit from happening. And probably in Detroit, you need to convert a lot of stuff to green space. You need to think about making a viable city that's going to have a smaller population than what it was before. It's very difficult to think of a plausible way to turn Detroit or St. Louis back into what they were 50 years ago at this point. But certainly to the extent that people are still living there and they're underemployed, if the government is establishing new things, that you should do that. Now, in this report we talk about is, with cars, GM, Obama's group, they did a corporate restructuring of GM, essentially, and on its own terms, had some success. But they also shut down a lot of plants. And they didn't ever consider the possibility of, hey, let's convert this to producing rail transit cars so that we can produce a greener urban infrastructure. That idea, people like me were talking about it, but it's never really entered the central thinking of the administration. But that would be a way to think about it, is if you can link need for employment with the need to provide a greener infrastructure and make use of the existing productive facilities before they decay and have a process and to convert those. You do that as much as you can. So you're not going to get Detroit back to where it was, but I think you can do a lot to help the people who are there. And also, I mean, right now in the U.S., when they buy railway cars, subway cars, it's mostly being bought from Europe because there's not domestic capacity because we've gutted our rail system over the last 40 years. So I would think in terms of basically, frankly, green industrial policy and targeting it to the places most in need. In terms of Quebec City, well, first of all, it sounds great, a lot more fun than Richmond. What I would say is that once you assure the right to capital, what you've done is you've taken the question of will the political community continue to exist in a viable form off the table. People know it will exist, and therefore you can begin asking higher order questions of justice. Now, I do think some of the things I talk about in terms of socializing capital, you could still do that in Quebec City. I mean, you could set up worker-owned firms, or community-owned firms, municipal-owned firms that maybe will be more just and, you know, on its own terms than traditional capitalist enterprise, and possibly you can get revenues from that that could be used to fund your 24-hour daycare or whatever it is you want to do. So basically I'm saying this creates the possibility to ask higher order questions, and you're not dominated by, oh my God, we're all gonna be unemployed, so therefore we have to give the businessmen what they want.
This is a terrific paper, and I really am looking forward to reading your book. I'm wondering, though, that it strikes me that here's a case where dependence upon super city, meaning state or provincial, nation state, and even supranational state cooperation and coordination would be very, very important, maybe predominantly important. So here's an example. Previous mayor of Toronto had this idea after visiting Sweden to encourage local industry to build these waste disposal mechanisms that would convert waste, local Toronto waste, into methane, which would then be used to drive the buses, which would also be locally produced. So it was both green and attracting and developing industry. Now, the current mayor is not sympathetic to this, partly because he's not sympathetic to anything that the former mayor did, and partly because he's not sensitive to things green. But he has another argument. There's an argument against it, and that is that this sort of effort could well fall afoul of free trade agreements, because it's giving, as it were, an unfair advantage to the local industries to impose, which we're actually doing, impose a stricture that that you have to have, it has to be green industry. Or even if you did do that, it's unfair to other jurisdictions who might be able to provide the buses and the machinery and the waste disposal things cheaper. So you'd have to tackle that'd have to be tackled, and a city can't tackle this. That can't be done alone by a city. It's going to require, at the very least, I think, federal intervention, and maybe you'd have to get into international fora.
Yeah, I certainly agree, and this is a major thing we're thinking about when we did the Making a Place for Community book, which is basically written in the 90s in the wake of NAFTA. And what you're saying is the reason I was against NAFTA, and and all my friends, not all my friends, but I think what the locality should do is push it as far as it can, and then when you run into the international obstacles, then you can start making the political claim, hey, this is a real problem here. We got to deal with this. But it is interesting that the way, I guess, cosmopolitan morality has been defined is cosmopolitanism equals global unrestricted free trade, and that has to be challenged head on. It's just, you have to make a moral argument against that. And yeah, it's that's going to be very, very hard. But I do think that there's a fair amount that can be done productively at the local level without getting into serious problems. I mean, I think it's not like there have been thousands and thousands of cases where local stuff has been struck down by the trade stuff.
So that question, and then a sort of a cautionary example. The question is, I wasn't quite clear what principle of justice helps us to choose which spaces, which geographical spaces get resources. So just to elaborate a little bit on that, the distribution of economic activity is quite uneven everywhere, right? There's urban metropolitan places have much more development and economic activity than rural places, for example. So continuing on that example, what would be the claim of someone who wants to alleviate rural poverty by subsidizing industry in those places, that is moving industry out of, say, the formerly industrial areas and moving it to a place that doesn't have very much industry? How do we make those kinds of decisions? And then the cautionary tale is sort of federal aid to cities and urban renewal, which was a massive influx of resources from the top to cities. Now, the way that was implemented was, I think, problematic and generated the growth machine, or was were the excesses of the growth machine politics that you're referring to. But that also failed quite miserably. That is, those resources were not able to prop up those locations. This goes to the debate about place versus person-based aid, right? And to a final point, which is, why characterize this as a place-based right, or a group right, or a city-based right, sort of place-based right, as opposed to just characterizing it as an individual right? And that goes back to whether you should just give money to individuals or you should actually give money to places.
Yeah, on the last part, I think the reason I think casting it solely, you know, some of you are familiar with this sort of David Ambrosio versus the world debate, in which he argues strongly for his place-based right and deny any kind of person. I'm more of a place and person thing, but I think the ecological stuff gives you a particular leverage of why we would want people to stay in cities. And I think the democracy argument, if you take the idea that local politics is where democracy is most possible, in a sense of really sustained participation, really being knowledgeable, really having some ability to hold your elected people into account, and then that's where we learn the skills, if we do it all, that are applied to larger scales of democracy. So I think both those reasons give you a strong case for wanting to keep the existing cities as viable communities, and so therefore, you know, partially place-based thing. But certainly, what I'm talking about has big implications for individual level justice as well. And that connects to the first question, which is what I would say is that, I'm not talking about distributing capital equally across all regions or cities. That would be a much more ambitious enterprise. I mean, I do think that in countries where you have really large-scale or regional inequities, that might be a good idea to have an explicit regional policy. But this is actually more focused on, I'm not talking about getting stuff from the West to the South. It's more, you know, the metropolitan areas that are suffering. But the principle would be that if the place has existed over time as a political community, that gives it a de facto right to continue to exist. And actually, I was interested in that several of the papers that cited Walzer, because I'm a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm a Rawlsian, and Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, I'm a Walzerian, and on Sunday, I'm a Marxist. So, but Walzer's Spheres of Justice, he actually has a good discussion in his chapter towards the end about property, in which he says, look, clearly, decisions to move factories to close things down are clearly political decisions, and therefore, it should be regulated, I would go with that kind of argument. Now, on the federal critique, yes, obviously, there are many bad examples of pumping federal money into elite-driven visions of redevelopment. But I do think if you make the focus employment on the people who live there now, and this is actually a place where I am sort of making a person-based argument. I'm saying let's not create the more beautiful cities in itself. Let's create the policies are going to help the actual disadvantaged people actually living in the cities. And I think that would be substantially different than what was done before. So there is a sense in which I am making a person-based argument and not just saying, let's make the city pretty.
So I love it. I'm in favor of it. But I do have two little questions. One follows up on Richard's question, and I was wondering if you could elaborate on what you mean by a right to capital. Would you endorse approaching this as a legal right? I'm thinking here in the South African Constitution that there's a right to housing, for example, and I mean, in a famous court case, this led to, you know, sort of compelling the municipality to allow squatters to build their houses on municipally owned land. And so that seems kind of exciting because it really gives institutional form to sort of these normative ideals. On the other hand, it's kind of problematic from a democratic perspective because then, you know, they're forced to devote resources to one particular group and that has these distorting effects and it doesn't allow them to weigh their competing priorities. So it's kind of complicated. So that's the political theory question. And then I have an empirical question. So on a basic level, I buy this, all right? I know about Mondragon and, you know, in Italy, 10% of the economies, the cooperative sector, the industrial districts in Emilia-Romagna, they're flourishing. They're doing well even despite globalization and there's all sorts of benefits in terms of, you know, kind of having local-based capital. So it seems plausible, but even though it's not Sunday and it's Friday, I'm kind of a Marxist. And I also think that Marx had some very good arguments against a cooperative sector because, you know, he felt that in a broadly capitalist marketplace, they're going to be subject to the same competitive pressures, and this is going to make it very difficult to achieve these social aims in that context. And so look at Mondragon. They're now outsourcing their production to suppliers in developing countries that are not cooperatives and don't pay living wages. And that's one of the ways that they compete. And so I guess I worry a little bit, or if you could say more about what convinces you that on a sort of smaller scale that these initiatives would prove to be economically competitive if they wouldn't otherwise be flourishing.
Right. That's a great question. It's in terms of the right stuff, I mean, yeah, the right to capital perhaps falls into the category of what Lauren was worried that was going on with the right to the city claim is a rhetorical excess. But seriously, if you were devising things from scratch, a constitution from scratch, I would think pretty seriously about a right to capital, a right to preserve existing communities. And someone could correct me, I think maybe Sweden actually has something like this for the outlying high up areas in the north. You know, there is a right to keep those communities alive. And you can relate to, you know, rights to indigenous people to have their communities preserved. You can imagine being in actual constitutions. But I would think of it, though, more in terms of both a moral claim, but also a constraint on how we shape policy and trying to adjust to climate change. That, look, no matter what else goes on, we can't continue to throw away our place, the existing cities. We just can't do that. It's ecologically irrational, and it has all these consequences for urban justice. And so I consider it, you know, as a constraint on policy with considerable moral force. You know, legally, how you get from there to here to there, I mean, I have to ask Richard about that, I recognize it would be difficult, but I feel like if the politics behind it was sufficient, you could make it work. I don't see anything there's NAFTA, but I don't see anything that would prevent you from, at least in theory, making it work if you had sufficient politics behind it. Now, on the empirically, on the sort of utopian socialist versus Marx and so forth, first of all, can they be viable? And short answer is, you start a bunch of experiments, you know, most small businesses fail. That's just a fact. It's the fact that they're cooperatives doesn't make them special. There is evidence that actually worker-owned businesses are much slower to lay people off and last longer. They don't have the same kind of incentive structure as a conventional firm and are inherently more stable. And there are also considerable literature showing that there are efficiency gains to employee self-management. You get rid of a layer of middle manager, create different incentive structures, and so forth. The way to get them off the ground, I think the Cleveland example is interesting because it's basically providing them, you get the existing things to pledge contracts, and that's the way to get them off the ground. And that's the biggest struggle with getting cooperatives off the ground is getting the capital together in the first place, and secondly, getting them their first job. And then, you know, obviously some will succeed, you know, and some will fail. And if they're terribly inefficient or aren't providing anything useful to anyone, then there's no reason to keep them alive. But I don't think the cooperative form itself will I'm not worried about inefficiency with the crop reforms. Now, the Mondragon now, though, it's become this global corporation that's expanded into China and all these other places. I'm a little bit more worried about that, actually, because once you get to a large scale, there may be it gets so large and so successful, begins acting fundamentally like any other corporation. And Mondragon plausibly is too large to have any real meaningful democratic participation, even for the people who are, you know, in Spain. So at some point, you know, I see cooperatives as part of the bottom-up strategy, but there has to be a top-down state planning apparatus going on as well to keep things in check.
Really interesting paper. Thanks. It seems to me that you gave sort of three different classes of reasons why we should take steps to, ensure this right to capital in cities. One has to do with just the disadvantaged people having to be there. And I think Richard sort of pushed you to think about that as not really specific about cities, because it could apply to wherever the disadvantaged people happen to be. Another is you gave us a whole series of reasons that cities perform better than suburbs along dimensions that we care about, like, for example, the environmental, and I think you mentioned diversity. And then a third is this kind of, the third I find the least convincing of the three. You seem to sometimes be sort of anthropomorphizing cities. We don't want these places to die. You know, they ought to be able to kept alive and everything. And I find that less convincing than the other two. In terms of the second one, it seems to me it would simply be a practical question, an empirical question, whether we might do better by making suburbs perform better along those dimensions than by trying to keep alive these dying places. So for instance, if we're concerned about the ecological questions, whether through regulations or incentives, try to change the house size, try to change the reliance on cars, try to change, for example, the homogeneity by, regulating exclusionary zoning and things like that. So it seems to me that it's just a practical question. Is there any reason not to simultaneously explore ways to make suburbs better along these dimensions that you care about if it seems like people are leaving cities and going to suburbs?
Well, no, there is no reason not to simultaneously do that. And I call our attention to this excellent book by Ellen Dunham Jones and June Williamson called Retrofitting Suburbia, which with a lot of examples from Atlanta, which shows how you could actually do this from a planning way. And they're thinking of a fairly drawn-out process. And yes, we need as much of that as possible. But I look at the climate change picture, and I think you have to throw everything at the wall you can. and that includes keeping the places that are relatively better off now and just not wasting them. And also think politically, it's more plausible they're going to get some change and action happening in cities and in suburbs. I mean, I think the political resistance to pursuing this kind of agenda, in at least in American suburbia, is so entrenched that you just won't get anything done if you made that your lead point. So it has to be a both. And also, we can't predict how social change happens exactly, but I guess I do have the idea that the more interesting examples we can create, we can sort of show people and eventually persuade people, and that could be seen. Now, the one exception, obviously, older suburbs might be a candidate for some of the stuff, the older decaying suburbs, which have similar issues about economic decay, might be good candidates for some of the stuff.
Great. Actually, on time. So for those of us who have badges, lunch is downstairs. For those of you who don't, sorry.